great competition always made us late enough. We were going to finish off damages for breach of contract and then move on to our next thing. So this is briefly through this, just to remind you of things you will already know. Damage for breach of contract, page 60. Yeah. So you can look down or look up, that was the plan today. Robinson and Harmon, 1848. The rule of the common law is that where a party sustains a loss by reason of a breach of contract, he is, so far as money can do it, to be placed in the same situation with respect to damages as if the contract had been performed. Okay, so the principle of common law damages is to put you in the position you would have been in if the contract had been performed. And this could be interesting in speculative transactions, obviously, you know, assuming you can identify what the position is you would have been in if the financial contract had been performed properly. What's the speculative gain you would have made? It's the difficulty in financial markets is often trying to work out what is the gain that you would have been able to realise. You know, would you have been able to buy and sell at that particular price? Would you have been able to get your deal in? Just as the market hit 100, you know, how do we know you wouldn't have bailed out at 95 and tried to make your gains at that point? So often, this is quite difficult to figure out in financial markets, but that's the basic principle, put you in the position you would have been in. In Ruxley Electronics and Forsyth from 1996, Lord Lloyd gives us this formulation. The authorities do not say that the plaintiff is always to be placed in the situation physically, as if the contract had been performed, but in as good a situation financially, so far as money can do it. This makes life easier for our purposes. Because the problem is, if you're talking about a construction contract, for example, you know, what you want is a house, you don't necessarily just want money. At least with financial transactions, typically, because the party's concerns are to make money. It makes life easier to identify what the damages are. Lord Jauncey says something similar. Damages are designed to compensate for an established loss and not to provide a gratuitous benefit to the aggrieved party, from which it follows that the reasonableness of an award of damages is to be linked directly to the loss sustained. So you've got to demonstrate that you have suffered a loss, and the lost opportunity cost is always a considered issue. And there's then this question of remoteness from Hadley and Baxendale, which I'm sure you've done as well in contract law. Where two parties have made a contract which one of them has broken, the damages which the other party ought to receive in respect of such breach of contract should be such as may fairly and reasonably be considered either arising naturally, i.e. according to the usual course of things, from such breach of contract itself, or such as may reasonably be supposed to have been in the contemplation of both parties at the time they made the contract, and the probable result of the breach of the affected part and the probable result of the breach of it. The contemplation of the parties, what financial markets have shown us since the summer of 2007, is that they can move in unexpected ways. And so one of the great questions, which I think we wait to see if it gets an answer during litigation that will undoubtedly follow the financial crash, is if you didn't expect the market was going to fall this badly, if it was in no one's contemplation that we would crash in the way that we have, does that mean that your loss, you know, goes beyond any notion of remoteness? Is it too great a loss? Is it much more than anyone could possibly have expected? I think there's an avenue for debate, there's an avenue certainly for litigation, but you know, for those of you that have fun with contract law, you know, follow that idea through. Stock market falls 40% in one day, the stock price of a particular bank falls 40% in one day, you know, how should the law on damages respond to that? Is that something which could not reasonably be supposed to have been in the contemplation of both parties? As I said when we went through master agreements a little while ago, you know, in outline, one of the things I always wanted to put in one of these kind of agreements is some statement as to what the party's general expectations are from their transaction. So if, for example, you've acquired an interest rate swap because you want to control the amount of interest you're going to pay on your loans, then I would suggest you want some statement in the contract which says that is your purpose. And thus hope to guard yourself against the possibility that interest rates may go absolutely wild as a result of a market movement, so that you actually end up paying far more under that contract than you expected. You expected that rates might move up, you know, 1 or 2% in the next 5 years, and then suddenly they jump up 10 or fall enormously or whatever it may be. You may end up paying far more than you anticipated, or receiving far less than you anticipated. So it seems to me that a statement of what you do reasonably intend from your transaction will guard you against all this and enable you to rely on the doctrine of frustration, the idea that your contract is frustrated and isn't fulfilling the purpose for which you entered into it. And it seems to me that's a way of protecting yourself in practice against a lot of these things. So to continue with Baron Alderson from 1854. Now, if the special circumstances under which the contract was actually made were communicated by the plaintiff to the defendants, and thus known to both parties, the damages resulting from the breach of such a contract, which they would reasonably contemplate, would be the amount of injury which would ordinarily follow from the breach of contract under these special circumstances so known and communicated. So it's an amount of injury which would ordinarily follow. And again, one of the things you need to make clear is if you're using your transaction for a particular purpose, and actually you may suffer some greater loss than the other side might realise, you need to make that clear in your contract from the beginning. And this is what's difficult in doing high volume business. For example, it's fairly common, we've mentioned options a few times, it's fairly common to take an option out to buy a share. So you think the price of shares is going to increase in the future, you take an option to buy the shares at a comparatively low price, because that's where the market is at the minute, and you hope the share price does tick up, so you can buy them at the low price and sell them at the high. You can also do that with commodities. You can gamble on copper. That's a gamble. You know, copper, wheat, any kind of commodity, gold, silver, whatever it may be. If you think that price is going to rise, the price of gold has rocketed during this crisis. And everyone suddenly wants gold in a very old-fashioned medieval way, because no one trusts money anymore. So what you might do is to say, I want a contract whereby I'm entitled to buy my gold at a particular price, my hope being that the market value will rise to higher than that price so I can buy it cheaply and sell it off immediately and make a profit. Now, typically those transactions are settled in cash, i.e. I don't actually want the gold, I don't actually want the copper, I just want the cash profit as though I bought them. Yeah? So we've discussed that in the past. Sometimes, however, there are transactions where a financial institution actually does want the gold delivered to it. Sometimes because it's got a customer itself who actually does want gold physically. Remember gold core and all the things we did in property too? You know, that kind of situation where you have customers, some of them actually do want the gold. Now, what traders often don't think is there's a different commercial purpose now because we actually want the gold physically. So what's the ramification for us if we fail to get the gold on the day we want it and our customer therefore doesn't get their delivery of gold for whatever they might want the gold for? Yeah? Or wheat, or iron ore, or whatever it is. On that basis, again, you need to put something in the contract which says we need this delivered on this particular date, not just because we want to charge you default interest if you deliver it to us late, but because we have an obligation to our own customer under another contract under which there may also be a penalty clause requiring you to compensate your own customer for loss. So all those kind of things, you know, very common in commercial markets, you need to think through the ramifications, particularly if doing something very similar to what you do 100 times a day, but on the odd occasion when it's slightly different, because those are always the ones that end up in court. Okay. So little things like this. So, you know, Baron Alderson had thought all of this through back in 1854. Many people on trading floors were thinking through today. But on the other hand, his lordship continued, if these special circumstances were wholly unknown to the party breaking the contract, he at the most could only be supposed to have had in his contemplation the amount of injury which would arise generally, and in the great multitude of cases not affected by any special circumstances from such a breach of contract. So if you don't make your special circumstances known to the other party, I need to deliver this gold to my own clients on the same day or that afternoon or whatever it may be, then the other person will not be liable for that consequent damage you're going to suffer. So you need to make these things clear. Good. And 9.3 just makes that point in relation to cash and cash settled and physically settled transactions. And this will be important for some things we do a bit later in the course. We've mentioned this before. Cash settled transactions are those transactions where all you want is the money. You want the amount of money you would have received as though you had actually bought the share and sold the share, or bought the gold and sold the gold. It makes finance into a kind of virtual activity, like a computer game. Yeah? I don't understand computer games, I'm far too old for this kind of thing, but my brothers love them, and it seems to be that you can pretend to have killed lots of people and not actually killed them, yes? Always a relief when you wake up and think, oh no, I didn't, that's okay. And some days you think, oh no, I haven't, that's a shame. So it's the same kind of thing. With cash-settled transactions, you aren't actually going to Thailand, buying the share in the Thai company, and selling it on the stock exchange in Thailand, and then repatriating the money once you've converted it back to sterling. Instead, you're sitting in your office in London, saying, let's gamble as though we were in Thailand, and as though we were buying the shares. So cash-settled deals are all about that kind of arm's-length speculation. It's a kind of virtual world. And so, you know, just looking at the bullet points, there's no securities nor commodities transferred. You receive the cash profit you would have earned as if you had acquired physical securities or commodities or whatever. And often what you do is you calculate your profit by reference to a nominal amount. You just say, let's suppose I was going to invest £1 million in this particular company. What profit would I have earned if I bought and sold on this in this particular week? And this is used for speculation primarily, sometimes used for hedging. If you have a particular exposure yourself to an interest rate because you've got lots of borrowing, and you decide that it's a particular share that tends to move in the opposite direction to interest rates, that's why you might enter into this kind of transaction, because you expect that one will balance out a loss in the other. And so all you're interested in these kind of situations is interest for late payment. All you want is money, and as long as you get interest late on, that's all right. But my computer's talking to you. Doing it. And it's true, it's heartfelt. Physically settled transactions, by distinction, is where you do want to take the securities or commodities physically. And on and on and on. So there are lots of questions you have to work out about in which jurisdiction you're going to be. And we'll talk about some of these issues of property law later on, but... if you're going to take securities physically, gold, copper, whatever it may be, you need to work out practical things like how you're going to store it. You also need to work out what's the governing law of your contract. If your copper is in Suntopia, let's make up a jurisdiction, yeah, and you're trying to ship it to where your bank is in Ruritania, you know, the various legal systems, how will you be able to enforce your proprietary rights over those commodities as you move them between jurisdictions? So there are lots and lots of detailed practical questions like that. And legal questions, as soon as you start dealing cross-border. You know, if all your stuff is about to be put in a boat, you know, at a port in Suntopia, which system of law is going to govern how it's shipped from that jurisdiction around the Cape of Good Hope and hopefully ending up in Tilbury Docks in London at some point? So all these kind of practical questions need to be thought through. So storage transfer conventions, and also, following on from what we said about Hedley and Baxendale, what kind of loss are you going to suffer if there is late delivery of your commodity, okay? If you yourself have some obligation to transfer to somebody else, okay? So I think that gives us a run through some of the key contract law issues in this area, and you'll be starting into your seminar talking about all that stuff, even.